CFO Radio is the only show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives for tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers, and Lee Cantor, our producer, if you'd like to introduce our sponsors.
Absolutely. Today, we'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, consulting services, and executive placement for finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of clients describe Delaney's as outstanding and excellent. And also, SAP Business by Design, a fully integrated business management software solution designed for small to mid-sized companies that want the benefits of large-scale business applications without the need for a large IT infrastructure.
This week's CFO News headline, CFO Magazine stated, among the ripple effects of the global credit crisis is the rewrite of the controversial fair value accounting rule, once known as FAS 157. The revised standard could be in place by the end of 2010. The debate over one of the most controversial accounting standards in recent memory is coming to a somewhat anticlimactic end. The rule, once known as FAS 157, which tells companies how to measure their fair value of their assets and liabilities, has been rewritten. It's now rechristened under the heading Topic 820. Now in final draft form, Topic 820 is open to comment until September 7. So if any of our listeners out there would like to go and comment, please go to the website and give your comments forward. Well, today Mark Borelli joins us to discuss the role of the CFO. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Mark, tell us a little bit about your background. We always start with understanding why you've come to the role and why you're so interested in the finance. You have a very unique background. You've got a JD in law, an MBA, and a degree in economics. You're also a chartered financial analyst. You're certified in mergers and acquisitions. You're a member of the State Bar of Georgia. And I'm taking a breath. And you hold several FINRA series licenses. Not exactly the traditional role to support the CFO. However, that's what you do today. Why did you choose this path?
Well, I think we all choose paths depending on how our experiences are shaped. And when I was in college in England, my family had a business in South Africa, which they sold. And the sale didn't go well. What basically happened was the deal closed on a Friday night, all the money was put in escrow, and over the weekend, the South African Reserve Bank froze all money transfers out the country. And looking back on that deal at the time, I realized it hadn't gone well, and maybe I should learn something about this. So that started my interest in mergers and acquisitions. I then went to graduate school and started my MBA, and then realized very quickly that lawyers seem to run a lot of things in the U.S. compared to everywhere else. So I got into law, a joint program, and did my law degree at the same time. And that gave my start. Then I worked for an investment bank in London, and during that time wanted to improve my financial analysis. And I think the difference there is a lot of people think of finance from an accounting perspective, but I wanted to get more into the financial and analytical role. So I got my CFA, which is a three-year program. And I think that's really helped. And it kind of took the whole MBA finance a little further. Like I say, after law school, I got the bar, and I took my Georgia bar license and got that. And
did you ever practice as an attorney?
No, I'm one of the many failed attorneys. There are a lot of us out there, but no, I never practiced. But
maybe not failed, maybe just chose a different path, huh?
Yes. I've kind of used it a lot, and I've read a lot of legal agreements in my time, but no, I've never actually practiced for anybody. And then the FINRA licenses really came in the last couple of years doing M&A work. Under the SEC definition, to advise anybody on the sale of securities or purchase securities, you need FINRA licenses, and so I got that as well. So that's a long story of how I got here, but my work has always evolved primarily strategy, merger and acquisitions, both externally as an advisor and then within corporates as well, reporting to the CFO and advising.
Now, in that regard, you've had some finance roles at some very large companies, at Equifax, at Six Continent Hotels, obviously now changed, before you took that lead role in M&A and the mergers and acquisitions. What lessons did they bring to you that helped you learn about the M&A world?
Well, I think my roles in all these companies involved M&A and just using finance. It wasn't like a separate finance role that moved into M&A, so it was always there. I think the thing if I was to say there's one thing you learn very quickly in the corporate world when you're working internally is you work on the deals from finding them, and then you value them, and then you, you do the actual transaction, and then you hopefully watch it make the money that everybody expected. And I quickly learned there's only really one certainty in an M&A deal, and that's the price. Everything else is an expectation of the future. And so getting that right becomes key, and doing your due diligence carefully, and then actually having a very good execution plan is very crucial. And the other thing is that we all get excited about M&A deals. You know, everybody talks about M&A, and everybody wants to tell you how much they've done. And my experience is we all get very excited, and our natural bias comes in. And so we start to only see the optimistic side of the world. Not that I want to be perceived as somebody who sees the glass half empty, but sometimes we have to realize the glass could be half empty, and we shouldn't get carried away with pure optimism because we have to justify those numbers later.
Are there any studies that have been done that might show the price paid and the original expected results coming from the combination of companies and showing whether it did or didn't achieve?
There have been a number of studies done, and I don't have them to hand, but I think if I can remember the numbers off the top of my head, ballparkish, something like 10 to 20% of M&A deals actually create shareholder value. The rest lose money.
That's pretty significantly low.
It is, when you think how many have been done, and they continue to get done, you know, and we can all think of examples of the bad one. I mean, I think, you know, probably at the moment a good classic of a really bad M&A deal was AOL Time Warner that just lost everybody a lot of money. So, yeah, there are lots of deals, and I think, you know, that's where you kind of hope people get their analysis right and start to pay more attention to some of the more subtle areas of it, not mm-hmm. just hard numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that regard, in terms of the analytics and obviously the side of you that is very much drawn to research, you started in that legal and economic world, and that is very, very heavy research. I'd like to take a couple of minutes and look at some of the articles that you've had published. You've had several published, and I'll focus on just a couple of them, and I'll reference them so that the listener can understand the context. Using expert systems to perform legal analysis in the UK, which was published by Software Law Journal. A second one is A Level Playing Field, Regulating Tender Offers in Friendly versus Hostile Takeovers, which was published in the Arkansas Law Review. And more recently, you've had several around the topic of, but I'll mention one, Five Reasons to Adopt Alternative Billing Strategies, which was published in the Atlanta Bar Journal Small Business Edition. Talk a little bit about the elements of perhaps what has come out in these articles. Maybe to start with, why would you take the time to write articles?
I think they started out, I was in graduate school, and I wrote software to try and pay my way through graduate school. You know, dating myself, it was back in the early 80s. PCs had just arrived. People were buying them. They were buying Lotus 1-2-3, and they didn't know what to do with them. And so I was writing code in different languages and in Lotus, which was the biggest programming language of all time, I think, by sure numbers. Anyway, trying to help people use these tools for better decision analysis. And I got very interested in an artificial intelligence language called Prolog. And I was in law school, so that's why I wrote the paper on doing legal reasoning using artificial intelligence, just because I was trying to think of systems that worked better. And actually, at the time, again, dating myself, I planned to work on using the same sort of software to try and find arbitrage opportunities in the bond market. But the market collapsed in 87, and that opportunity went away. The second paper, Level Playing Field in Hostile versus Friendly Takeovers, that was just out of my interest in M&A work. Most of my law education was in the M&A field, and I was very interested. I did a lot of reading in it. So it was an opportunity to write a paper, and I thought I'd do that. And that's kind of how you get started. You start writing something, you think, oh, well, this is a good idea. I'll do it and take it a little further.
Had you been involved in any hostile takeovers?
Not up until that point, but I have when I was working in the UK. Actually, the first transaction I ever worked on in London was a very hostile takeover.
Explain to the listener a little bit about that.
Well, in this case, a hostile takeover is you have a... Well, first of all, I have to clarify, the UK system is somewhat different from the US system in the public markets. But what basically happened to some degree is in the UK, unlike the US, shareholders truly decide what's going to happen in a deal. In the U.S., the board decides, the management decides, and then can choose where they want to go. And our client at the time was a small oil and gas company, and there was a large old English traditional company that agreed to do a deal with a third company, which the market didn't really like, and the price hadn't gone anywhere. And our client saw an opportunity to acquire this company and take half its assets that it wanted. So we launched a bid for it. Our client was a company called Kelt Energy, and we were acquiring a company called Carlos in the UK, and Carlos definitely did not want to be acquired by a young upstart like Kelt. And so it was very hostile. There were a lot of articles in the press about how it wouldn't work, and basically in the UK it's up to you to persuade the shareholders. So there were press articles going backwards and forwards. There were letters to shareholders going backwards and forwards. But eventually we managed to get the price to a point the shareholders agreed, and we won the deal.
So how's the company doing today?
Kelt is still around, I think. Actually, I haven't looked in years. But, you know, that was an interesting experience because when the deal started, again, going back to analytics is where we all start this stuff. And I was talking about earlier, I think interest rates in the UK were about 8%. And within a year, they were at 16%.
I remember those times. I was there. I was paying a mortgage.
Right. And, yes, because we didn't have fixed rate mortgages in the UK at that time. So I think that was quite interesting because our analysts hadn't allowed for interest rates to go that high. We'd, I think, capped out at about 12 or 13. So they got definitely squeezed on the back end of the deal. And I think they had to sell more assets than planned. So they didn't quite get the value they saw out of it. But it was an interesting experience.
Interesting. So in that regard, how has all your experiences, and you're talking about some of the history, and clearly you have a very international background, how has that role of analytics changed over the years?
I think, it's benefited very much from things, programs, like I said, starting with Lotus 1, 2, 3, and then into Excel. We now can calculate all sorts of things that we couldn't do before. And we can do lots of versions of it and scenarios of it. Unfortunately, as I tell people, the great thing about Excel is we can calculate numbers to 9 decimal places. The problem is the number's wrong. And I think this was brought home to me way back, again, very early in my career, when I was talking with my boss on an evaluation I'd done on one of these takeovers, and I showed him my very well-built model that showed cash flow of 10 years and discounted back in this valuation. And he said to me, do you think that's the value? And I said, yes. And he said, what sort of range? And I quantified it a bit with a range. And he said, so are you willing to bet your entire salary and bonus that they will make the numbers they've projected for this year? And we were about 3 months into the year. And I said, no. And he said, well, if you're not willing to bet this year, why will you bet 10 years from now? So how much value do you think this has? And that led me back to something I studied in school, error calculations when you're doing physical experiments, and sort of make me think, you know, because computers give us this very nice result, very easily wrapped up, and they calculate all these decimal places, we think it's right. But we forget to say that there are margins of error, and we have to look at these things, and we have to try and quantify what the true numbers are. And I think, again, it's amplified by our society that everybody wants an answer. You know, the typical question you get from a CEO or a business division leader or even the CFO is, what's the number? And you turn around and you say, well, there is no number. There's no magic number. You know, there's a range, and the range depends on various factors, and people don't want to hear ranges. They want numbers. And I think that leads to a lot of, I hate to use the word bad decisions, but decisions made on too little information and too little understanding of what's truly happening.
And is that where earlier you described the optimism side of our emotions drawing us to take a certain decision?
Right.
That's at play.
Yes. I think that, again, we want to hear the positive side. We're always looking for what we think is the right side. And we all have natural biases, every one of us. And our bias is built by what we've done. And so we don't even recognize that the bias is in play. I think the classic example is in a company. We tend to believe we control our destiny, especially in smaller companies where you have a CEO who founded the company and runs it because he built it up. He believes he controls it. And what you have a hard time explaining to him sometimes is, yes, you control what actually happens, but really you only control certain variables. Everything is dependent on the outside that you have no control of. And so you need to build more risk analysis. And I think that's what's happening to analytics today with computing power and price of computers falling so dramatically. You know, I think I read somewhere that there's more computing power in our BlackBerrys than there was in the first space shuttle, just to put it in perspective. So with that sort of power, programs and tools that were developed for the oil and gas industry 10 years ago, 15 years ago, are now available to the average company, and we can make better decisions.
Talking of those better decisions, what about the availability of dashboards to monitor financial performance? Talk to us a little bit about that.
I think dashboards are great. I think there's one of the interesting things in the world today is, again, with all these computer systems and companies have them and lots of data, is we get overwhelmed with data. I think there's no problem with data. Actually, there's too much data. What we do lack is intelligence. and there's a distinction between them.
I'm getting a sense that your next degree might be psychology here.
No, actually, I'd like to do another degree in risk, but that's just where we go. But no, I think that so I think dashboards are crucial, especially for CEOs and CFOs. And I think one of the great things today is that historically when, you know, a CFO wanted a dashboard to show them what was happening in the company, it was a huge IT project. He had to work with the IT group. It got put on the list of IT projects and would somebody roll around 3 years later, by which time the items he was looking for were no longer really relevant. But thankfully, again, with what's coming out in the software, you know, I've built dashboards for clients which will just take data straight off an Excel spreadsheet. So their QuickBooks can export to Excel. We can build it very quickly. Within 2 weeks, they can have it operating. It can track real-time numbers. And then they can start to see what's really happening and start to focus on what the key numbers are. And one of the interesting things when you build dashboards for CFOs and CEOs is the first dashboard they tell you they want, I've quickly learned, is never the one you end up with, because once they start to see the data and understand it, they start to realize actually they're not always looking at the right numbers and they need to look at certain different numbers. And I think that just comes with better understanding of the analysis. So I think that's a really great advantage in the market today. And I think more CEOs and CFOs are not always aware of it. I mean, the person who introduced me to dashboard software worked for a major company in the Atlanta market and was a CFO. And he said, if only I had had this data when I was CFO, it would have been great. But he said, you know, I'm still making it today, even though they're a massive company, because their IT systems just can't deliver it on time. So, you know, I think if you're listening to the show and you can get it, start talking to people about what is the data I really need to see, not the masses of paper that people dump on your desk, but something that's quick, easy, and allows you to analyze what's happening.
So for our listeners, explain, what is a dashboard? What are the main elements that make a dashboard rather than what you're describing as the wad of paper?
I think dashboards, as I perceive them, is something you can look at on your computer screen, which is interactive. So we've all seen PowerPoint slides, pages and pages of graphs. What I think differentiates a dashboard from pages and pages of graph, it is a slide that allows you to either drill down into a number to see what makes it up, allows you to see variances much quicker, allows you to overlay numbers and charts. Basically, it's all charts. I think the key on dashboards is not, again, we're not focusing on the number. We're trying to get emphasis on scale.
And trend.
And trend. And those are the key things. And you can get those very quickly.
And do you do this with what-if scenarios in a moving capacity?
Yeah, the logic's all underneath it, but you can do that. And a lot of it's just based on historical data. But what you can do is suddenly slice and dice a lot of historical data very quickly. So if you're selling goods, you can look at, you know, the typical, what are the sales of the different goods? What are the margins of the different goods? And then what's the actual profit? You know, your most largest profitable item may have your lowest margin. You've got to understand those differences. And then again, what distribution channels are the most effective? Who are the most effective salesmen? A lot of this data is there, but it's very hard to look when you have to go through maybe 15, 20 pages of a spreadsheet to see what the trends are, mm-hmm. because you're flipping backwards and forwards. And, you know, I think also it's very hard for us numerically to look at numbers. You know, and I think the most classic example is we all talk about dashboards because the term comes out of the auto industry. We look at a dashboard dial. And we can, even if you look at cockpits and aircraft, which have tons of instruments, it's all dials. And I think the reason is the human eye can quickly look at a dial and see where it is relative to something. Hard numbers don't really mean that much to us. We have to think a lot more about them. And I think that's the purpose, is to quickly look, see the relevance, and then figure out what you want to do with that information, rather than try and figure out what a hard number means.
So taking that one step further, in preparing for the show, you and I talked a little bit about decision analysis within the financial decision-making process. Take that one next step.
Well, what we're doing with clients right now is trying to explain to them that when they look at decisions, again, it goes back to my earlier point, there's no single number. And I think this affects companies in multiple ways, and they don't always understand them. And so when you build your Excel spreadsheet of your sales forecast for the year, what typically happens is somebody says to the sales manager or whatever, you know, what is your estimate for sales for this year? And he comes up with the average. What he thinks is probably where that number is going to be. And then you say to him, well, what's the low worst case? And you get a worst case. And then you, what's the best case? And so there are the three cases. Now, if you have more than one product, let's say you have 10 products, you now have 30 cases. It's hard to suddenly see where all this information is going. The other problem is people pick the average, but as we all remember about the average, if you've got a 50% chance of being below it and you've got a 50% chance of being above it.
So you do tend to use a normal distribution around that average?
Not always. May use a different type of distribution depending on what we're looking at.
Okay.
But yes, we're looking at a distribution. And so what we're trying to do is take all the variables that we can't control. I mean, we can control salaries and rent and certain overhead, but sales we can't control, volumes we can't control, and put them on a distribution. And then say, okay, if we run this model 10,000 times through the distributions, then what does it show the averages? And again, a lot of people make mistakes that the average of all the different inputs is not the same as the average of each input summed up. So you get some better analysis, and then you start to see what the real downside is. Again, going back to my earlier assumption, what's the worst case? Well, you know, if you have the worst case and we figure it's maybe a 10% chance of happening, and we have three product lines, then, you know, the probability of all three coming in worse, which is what people look at, is 0.1 to the third power, which is so small, it's really insignificant. So that doesn't really help us anymore. Again, we have a data point, but it doesn't mean anything. So I think the advent of analytics is now to start using scenarios, Monte Carlo simulations, to use a statistical term, and a lot of statistics, really, to get a better understanding of what is the most probable outcome, and then what are the risks, what is the true downside risk, and what variables are affecting that risk. And then we can then take it the next step and say, okay, now what do we do to minimize those risks? Is there money we can spend to learn more about the markets? Can we spend money to find out what consumers want? And we can quantify what the value of that information is and decide whether it's worth spending or not.
So taking that one step further, our beginning newscast talked a little bit about FAS 157, potential changes to fair value accounting rules, now what is known as Topic 820. The decision analytics, the dashboard, the risk element of all these moving parts in the analytics. Take us back to that element of fair value, the M&A, and the number that you're asked for.
I think it was interesting. I was looking at this, and you know, the understanding, as I understand, not being an accountant, but there are three levels and within Topic 820 of how you value things. And M&A, where you're valuing companies you've bought, is what they call level three. So it's the most obscure, and you have to figure out what would you be able to sell this business for in a market to come up with a value. And that's going to be based on all sorts of assumptions. Again, I think one of the things is if you do this analysis, you can truly figure out what the range is on value. Again, because of accounting rules, they want a number. They don't want a range. They won't accept ranges in your accounts. But I think you can come maybe to a better expectation of what the number is. It's hard, though. You know, it's the old thing is, there are lots of valuation models, and as an M&A person, I get asked all the time what the value of my company is, and I say I can, you know, value it on discounted cash flow, multiples of sales, multiples of earnings, multiples of EBITDA, asset values. But at the end of the day, it's what is a willing buyer going to pay a willing seller, and that's the requirement within this area, is what would a buyer pay a seller. But, you know, we don't know that until we put it in the market. So I think, again, it's the quality of the assumptions you want to put in there. Now, without being mean, I think one of the problems, too, is, as I recall under the rule, if there's a diminution in value, you have to take it through the P&L account, which nobody ever wants to do. So what often happens is you work out the assumptions, you come out with the value, and if it's not the value you like, you go back and rework the assumptions, which is a bit cruel, but I think that does happen to a degree. But, I think people do that. But I think truly understanding the assumptions and the parameters around them, you can make a better decision. And if there is a diminution in value, maybe it's better to recognize that rather than hang on to something that is losing value but we don't want to recognize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, in the accounting world, we are such pessimists that we always tend to take the hit immediately and now at the worst-case scenario, and we don't tend to accrue those profits and benefits and bonuses in life.
Well, that's true. I mean, the sad thing about the rule is if the value is decreased, you have to write it off, but if the value goes up, you can't add it back, which I think is, you know, we need to figure that out. But that is a bit of a problem.
I think as we move into the IFRS, the International Financial Reporting Standards, when we get into that more broad international view that both you and I have been in, different countries have very different perspectives. Valuations, impairment of values has been a key element for that IFRS versus US GAAP. I don't know necessarily that we'll easily come to a middle ground, but I think we are coming closer.
Yes, I think it's interesting, as you say, we've experienced in different countries, and I think every country has something to offer this system. And our way of doing it in this country is not necessarily totally the right way, and we need to be willing to compromise a bit sometimes and understand things. And then there are things we do better.
Yeah, I remember first early in my career, I was probably in my low 20s, and I went to an international company, and part of the audit was to the company that I was auditing was doing some kind of sales abroad, and it was a Russian deal, and they shipped, I don't even remember what it was, they shipped a boatload of X, and in reparation for this boatload of X, the guy standing on the dock was meant to get a couple of suitcases full of cash, as tends to be the way in Russia. And Stratovir looking on the other side said, "Oh no cash today. See that other ship full of, I think it was some kind of wheat or corn or something like that." He said, "You take that." And me as the poor auditor had to kind of figure out how on earth you account for that. I certainly wasn't a valuation expert in any bushels of corn, but it's a different world.
It is. And, I think you have to adjust to the different world. I mean, you talk about that, and again, this is not a thing I would recommend, but I remember looking at a company in Italy, and we asked the owner to show us his books, and he showed us his books, and we noticed that in every year there was a consulting fee that was pretty close to the profit, and the company basically made no money since it started. And we asked him about this, and he was so proud as he told us that actually it was his cousin who lived in Switzerland used to just submit an invoice to get all the profits out of Italy. And you kind of explain, well, that's great, but we can't do that. We have certain legal requirements we have to. And he's like, but then you have to pay taxes. Yes, unfortunately. So, yes, it does work differently in different countries.
That's how the system works, huh?
That's right.
But, talking of which, I'll tell one brief story. I remember 20-odd years ago meeting a Russian woman that had just moved to Germany, and she sat down. She'd been working, I think, a week or two, enough to get one pay packet. And she told us bold-facedly that her employer was a fraud and he hadn't given her all her money. And her husband, who she was newly married and he had newly brought her to Germany, said, "Let me take her aside and explain taxes." Yeah, funny old world. Well, we're getting on to a lot of topics of value and real core value. In order to get that core value, obviously you have a financial history of results and of operations. But how do you take that next step into the forecasting? You talked about your desire to get very much more into that risk-based modeling. Forecast is a very key risk-based model. How do you use forecasting in the business? How do you help your client companies to use forecasting to meaningfully drive that bottom result?
I think that, as you said, forecasting is really where the future, where we look for the future. But I think people need to be careful in that. I like to think the further out we get in forecasting is not accurate anymore. It's more of a guideline, and we're looking for guides as we go into the future. But one of the things I tell a lot of companies that I have worked with in the past is that as you look forward, one of the helpful things is looking back as a guide to the future. And so I think with a lot of companies, especially the big companies, we prepare these budgets and then we see how we're doing, and there's all this variance analysis, and a lot of it's good. And it helps understand how we got to where we are. But I see a great deal of variance analysis coming out of the finance area of the company showing what all the variances are, but you don't always see a very good explanation of, A, why the variance is there, and then, B, how we're going to prevent it, looking for the causes of the variance. And so I think one of the key things, as I tell companies, is do a budget every year and a plan, and then, measure your performance against it. And if you start to see a variance, try and understand what's causing it and what you're going to do to prevent it, and write it down. And so if it doesn't work, you, A, know you didn't fix it and why. Or maybe not why, but at least one thing you tried didn't work. And if it does work, you start to get a better idea of what does work. And as you do this more repeatedly, it becomes an iterative learning exercise. And so as you start to forecast further out, you start to see, okay, these are my projections. They're based on what I've done in the past, and I have a lot of sense for these because I've done this so often. And especially in smaller companies, what I find is CEOs who founded the company and run it, I don't like to say that, by the seat of their pants, but they don't actually think a lot of this stuff through. It's all in their brain, and they know it if you can dig deep enough into their brain. But
it's almost intuitive.
It's become subconscious, yes.
Subconscious.
And so when you say to them, well, how did you get here? How did you plan this? They don't know. And you actually have to sit down for a while and try and extract that information. And I keep saying to them, if you take it and you write it down and you put these plans together and you track them, at some point in the future, if you want to sell your business or raise money, go to a bank, and you can show them this history and this process you go through that has a lot of credibility to it, it's a lot easier because people are lending on the future, and the future we don't know.
Mm-hmm. And obviously your work today, you've been at very large companies, you've been in multinational M&A deals. Your work today that you're describing is one aspect of how you help that smaller family-owned business, the business that perhaps is that second or third leg of growth and is looking to grow, and now they're really looking at putting in good sound modeling to enable them to determine what that growth is going to be and to help cash flow forecasting, profit forecasting, and beginnings of valuation.
Right. And I think what happens when I work with smaller companies, it's very interesting because a lot of smaller, it depends on the person's background, but they look at the top line growth very effectively. They probably look at profit to some degree. Most of them don't look at cash flow that much. I mean, they probably did when they started because they were very worried whether they're going to make payroll and could they afford the rent. But once the business gets to a size where it's actually quite well established and they're well off, I mean, you know, when we get to people who are pulling in, a couple hundred thousand a year, a million a year, they don't really track the cash flow that much that I've noticed. They might have some numbers they can show you, but if you said to them off the top of how much is your cash flow net, they don't really know. And they start to see the company in some ways as an open till that they reach in and out of, as the case may be, to support their lifestyle. And it was quite interesting. I was doing some work with a relatively large private company. And they had this wonderful growth. And they were very proud of their growth. But when I showed them they're actually losing money, not losing money because they actually made a profit, but cash, they were taking so much cash because their margins weren't high enough and their working capital was killing them that eventually they were going to run out of cash. And I don't know if they were going to get financing. They were quite surprised by that. And so, I think it's very important, again, for the smaller companies to look at it, that the valuation, at least in my opinion, is what's the cash flow coming out. I mean, that's the underlying core of our valuation theories in the world today, is that it's the future value of cash discounted back. And so you need to understand how much cash is actually falling out of the bottom.
That's a main crux of that M&A, I was going to say argument, that's the wrong word, debate, is it on an EBITDA or is it on a cash flow? And in a perfect world, the two would be the same, but they're not.
No. I think, actually, I was asked this question recently, and again, my answer may be different from most of the world's, but I think if we look at it, back 10 years ago in the dot-com boom, everybody looked at revenue. There were multiples of revenue, multiples of eyeballs, multiples of whatever you wanted to think of, nothing tied to reality, but big numbers. We then had a lesson that really didn't work, and then we went to EBITDA. And the reason for that was people said, well, there's EBIT, but you've got this depreciation charge, and that's not really fair because that's not a cash item, and we're trying to estimate cash. But I think one of the interesting things when I look at it is I say to people, yes, but you have to reinvest in companies. I mean, you can go a period with not investing, but at some stage you've got to start spending on capital equipment and investments. So I think we may even return to an EBIT number again to some degree because I think if people say, well, I want to exclude the depreciation, well, where's the capital spend? So we've either got to take an EBITDA number and then put an estimated capital spend back, or we're going to have to go back for EBIT as the approximate. But at the moment, EBITDA is still the most common term as a proxy for cash.
Now, have you seen any change in terms of that modeling and M&A and valuation? Last 2 years, we've had, certainly in the U.S. markets, we've had a significant impact of the economic times, interest rates and so forth. What's been the impact?
From what I'm seeing on the modeling side, I think the deals are still initially done at a high level because what we're seeing is whether it's a strategic buyer or a private equity group, they're looking for the competency of the management team and the basic value proposition of the company. And if they like those two, they're going to do an estimated value on some very rough numbers. But then the serious modeling has to get in. And I think where the problem is, it comes back, and again, we're going back to earlier in careers. I don't know if you were in the UK in the early 90s. But I remember a lot of companies getting into a lot of trouble, and a lot of companies now in the U.S. have gotten to the same position where they have lines of credit from banks or they have loans from banks, and the banks are in trouble, and they're looking to pull in whatever loans they can. And so you suddenly breach some small banking covenant, and the next thing your loan's being called. And so now the modeling is getting a lot more complicated in that the private equity groups, at least, were doing a lot of financing in their deals, a little bit of equity and a lot of debt. And now you have to model all this debt and make sure you're not going to breach any bank covenants and loan covenants that could get you into trouble. So I think the modeling in that aspect is getting a lot tougher. But again, it goes back to, are we taking one single point to get to another single point, or are we looking at a risk profile?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In that risk profile. You mentioned something a couple of minutes ago. You said that once the decision has been made, and then you mentioned something about the analytics. So now you've made the decision, you've done analytics, you've made a decision to buy a company or to go acquire capital equipment or whatever that management and strategic decision was. Does that stop the analytics or does the analytics go on?
No, I think it should always continue because I think even when you've made a decision, there's still other decisions to be made. And the problem is that, if you think of decision analysis, it's those multiple tree branches spreading out and all the different ways we can go down a route to get somewhere. Well, just because we've made one decision, it probably cuts off maybe half the branches, but we still have all the others to look at.
But in reality, does the company then expend the time on the employee to continue analyzing that previous decision?
Often not, no. And we also get very hung up in the corporate world because people's bonuses and careers depend on it. So often is that we keep looking at what we've spent to date. And really, from an economic perspective and a risk, and what you've spent. You can't get it back. And the question is now, is it worth spending more to fix it or not? That's the decision, not what have I spent already. But
that opportunity cost.
Right. Whereas people look back and say, well, we've spent X, so, what do we do? Well, there's nothing you can do. You've spent it. The question is the opportunity cost going forward. And I think that's an area which gets left out a lot.
And then us accountants come around the rear and say, well, if you spent it and it's deferred, you now make a new decision. You got to hit the P&L. You're whacked either way, right?
You really are. And I think that's where the problem is we all want on both sides. We want to take the best of all the opportunities. And, again, your accountants know this, but on the M&A side, I was speaking to somebody the other day who said to me, he said, when you're advising clients, have you explained to them all the tax advantages they can take on the sales structure? And I said, yes. But I said, the problem is somebody's going to pay the tax. So if the buyer's going to pay the tax, he's going to reduce the price. I mean, somebody's paying. And they're like, why? And I'm like, because you can't have it all. You can't give the buyer all the tax liability and expect to get the same price. And they couldn't quite see that.
So we've talked an awful lot about this, and we mentioned a little bit earlier about your law degree and your experiences in law. Perhaps elaborate a little bit more on that. How has your experiences and learning and education in the law helped with these kinds of transactions?
Well, I wouldn't claim to draft anything. I've drafted a few sections of agreements in my time, but I think where it's helped and where I like it is that I understand what the lawyers are saying, which is good, and you sit in these negotiations. But I think where some lawyers lose, and I don't like to use the term focus, but they get very involved in the legal argument. And there was a case where we were acquiring we were doing a joint venture agreement. There was a lot of discussion, again, about liability coming back to my client, who was a much larger company and had the wherewithal, and the other side of the joint venture was a startup. So we would get exposed if there was liability. And the lawyers had got themselves totally worked up for about 3 hours arguing over these issues of legal liability. And what we were able to do is, looking at it from a purely finance point of view, is to say, well, how big is this risk? And at what point does the risk come into effect? And the solution was, just give us a put option on the shares. We'll put them back to the startup company for $1, and he's got all the liability. And so I think one of the great things is when you've got the financial aspect and the legal aspect, you can sometimes withdraw from the legal and say, okay, but what is true cost here? Is this cost worth what we're arguing about? And is it such a big issue that we need to spend so much time? And I think, lawyers are drafting because they want to draft very nice, well-structured documents. But sometimes you look at it and say, this really, the quantifiable amount of money we're talking about at the end of the day is actually lower than the hours we've spent arguing about it. And we need to just draw a line.
So in that regard, are you an advisor to that company that is going through the transaction in addition to helping with the financials and the analytics and the software?
We sit through all the negotiations with lawyers. We read all the documents from a business perspective, and hopefully we can help the lawyers, but I don't claim to draft legal documents. But yes, we sit and advise them and try and give them the best outcome they can. Mm-hmm. To be perfectly honest, if any of your clients are ever selling, or anybody's selling a business, I always tell them, or even if they're buying a business, I tell them, don't come to the negotiation. Tell your lawyers and your advisors what you want, and then don't come. Because in my experience, whoever you're selling to or buying from, unless it's a very small company, you've got a committee on the other side. They cannot make a decision that they can be held to. They have to go back and get permission. And if you're the owner, you've said it. It's done. So you're putting yourself at a huge disadvantage.
Interesting, interesting. Well, that being said, in order to develop some of the things that you've talked about, dashboards, decision analytics, and through the M&A deal, very often you might think that you need a significant budget, that capital investment, in order to set these up. Talk a little bit about what is involved, what is needed, and is it really a large budget that you need?
I don't think it is. I actually think prices have come to a point now where you can get a lot of stuff done incredibly cheaply. And I would say with the current economic environment, it's got even cheaper. I mean, if you look on websites like Elance where people bid for work, it's amazing some of the prices people are asking work to be done for. But I think, no, budgets don't need to be that large. I think what you need is a budget. Let's say if it's a dashboard, it could cost you $10,000 to $20,000. So some people might say, ouch at that. But the question is, what does that save you? What we stop doing sometimes, and especially for a busy CFO who has so many calls on his time, because usually from what I've seen, the CFO looks after HR and he's got IT under him and a bunch of other things. So he's got all these demands on his time. And if he can have something on his computer screen that can show him in 10 minutes what it took him 3 hours to wade through pages and pages of reports, that's worth something. And he needs to quantify that. And I think that probably is worth $10,000 for a good dashboard.
And is it the systems that are helping in this capacity? You're putting in place systems as well as dashboards so that once you've implemented these kind of dashboards, the company, the CFO, the CEO can go through and put that new what-if scenario.
Yes, we can do that as well as just look at the historic data. But it's just, you know, it's helping him make a better decision, be more informed about the key variables and not all the variables. So I think that's important. On the decision analytics, excuse me, again, you can hire consultants who will come in and do this and help you get to a better decision. I think there are two things. Is from a lot of CFOs who don't really remember much of their statistics that they took way back in college, you don't actually have to know statistics. You have to understand some relatively basic concepts. The consultants can do all the work, and then as long as you understand the concepts, I think you can get along just fine. What it does require in all these things, though, is your time. And what I find interesting enough is a lot of CFOs that I talk to say, we'd love this. Can you do it? And you're like, but I need you because I need to build what you need. And they're like, well, I'm really busy. And so that, I think, is the hardest thing. You have to find the time to make the investment, but it will pay off.
That being said, let's make sure that the listeners understand the company name that you have, Kaizen Solutions LLC. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about Kaizen, the name, and how it kind of plays in.
Kaizen is actually a Japanese word. It came out of Toyota. It means continuous improvement. And I took it just at the time because I was trying to help people improve processes. You know, I think the old continuous improvement, we develop a process and we often leave it because we've developed it. But can it be improved? And I think the whole concept that came out of this, and I think it was done at Allied Signal and others, was looking at the concept of best practices. And what they said was best practice is not just best practice in our firm or in our industry, but actually best practice across all industries. Can we learn something from other industries? And I think that really was what I was interested in trying to help companies with. And you mentioned earlier some of the papers I've written on alternative billing strategies for law firms. And that was because I saw a bit of that trend happening in the market in the last 2 years and was saying to people, you know, in law firms, which had definitely gone on an hourly basis, you know, what's your value proposition to your customer? And it's not your hourly rate necessarily. And so how do you do these things? And then you get down to how do we make the process better? How do we improve it? And, you know, what processes should we focus on or not focus on?
Well, that being said, we have a tradition on our show in terms of wrap up to ask all of our guests, what is your CFO tip of the month? Mark, what is yours?
I think for all CFOs that I meet with, my tip of the month is to understand your risk better that you face. Not just what do you expect, but how close is that risk and what is the true bottom line of that risk? You know, going back to the modeling thing, if the expected value of your numbers says you're going to make a profit of $3 million, that's wonderful. But if I can show you on a risk profile that, yes, that's the expected value, but you've got a 40% chance of losing six, you might want to worry about that more than expected value. So
that's a great tip. Thank you very much. And we would like to thank you, Mark Borelli, our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thank you also to our contributors, We would also like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. And thanks also to SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small to medium-sized companies. For more information on their product, please go to www.sap.com. This and other thought leadership about today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks again for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chalvers signing off. Until next time.